Good afternoon, Radioland, and welcome to Endeavors on CGSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby. We're also on CGSF.ca, where you can podcast and stream Endeavors and all your other favorite CGSF shows. And you can find us on TELUS HD channel 7014. We have a very informative and awesome show for you today. My first guest is retired NASA astronaut and the first Canadian man to walk in space. And he's the author of a new book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. Chris Hadfield will be here. In the second half, you'll hear from longtime member of Blue Man Group, Russell Rinker will talk to us about all things blue and how it differs from his other acting projects, such as being on Arrested Development, performing Shakespeare, and opera. And finally, our music guest today is local band Spring. They have a new band, Celebrations. That's how we're going to start the show today. This is their song, Follow. Was Spring with Follow off their album Celebrations, and you'll be hearing from them a little later on in the show. But right now, my first guest is a retired commander with NASA and the Canadian Space Agency. He has thrown He has flown into space three times, twice on the shuttle, and most recently in 2012 on the Russian Soyuz. He was the first Canadian to make a spacewalk, as well as the first Canadian to be commander of the International Space Station, which he did when he took over and led Expedition 35 from December 2012 to May 2013 and took over as commander in March of 2013. He's been back for a while now, and since he's been back, he wrote a book called An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, and his Zero Gravity music video cover of David Bowie's A Space Oddity has reached millions of views on YouTube. He is Chris Hadfield, and I spoke with him last week. I'm joined on the phone now by Commander Chris Hadfield. Commander, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Dan. Good to be with you.
So, how is it being back on Earth? Have you fully recovered yet?
Yeah, it's great to be back on Earth. You know, I flew in space three times, and as you know, the last time I was away off the planet for almost half a year, and it is, of course, a wonderful experience, but it's great to be back. There's a lot of changes that happen to your body when you're in weightlessness for that length of time, but I've recovered from most of them. A lot of them mimic aging, but it's interesting that they reverse the, you know, it's a weird thing we're studying. But the one that's lasting the longest, Dan, is osteoporosis. I lost about 8% of the bone across my hips. But what's amazing is it's reversing. My osteoporosis is reversing, and hopefully within about 3 or 4 months, I'll be back to as normal as I'm ever going to be.
Can you describe? I mean, you mentioned you've taken three trips to space, but you didn't actually get to spacewalk until your second time in 2001. Can you describe that first moment when you first stepped out into space?
Yeah, that's an amazing moment, not only in my life, but at this point still a historic kind of thing that we're doing. And the reason I say that is not just personal. I mean, personally, it's phenomenal to grab onto the yellow handrails that are there to carefully pull yourself through the round hatch of the spaceship and out into the universe. It's such an amazing transition of place. But at the same time, beyond the thrill of doing that as a person, historically, to see the world that way is something new, where you're not standing on the surface of the world looking up at the universe, but you are in the universe with the world, and the two of you are going around the sun together. And to see the world in that single entity perspective, the world is a ship that we're all riding on. That is a really mind-changing place to be, and the inherent pouring beauty of it, combined with the rare perspective of it, it makes for just an amazing experience. I walked in space twice. I was Canada's first spacewalker, and spent about 15 hours outside building Canadarm2. So I went around the world about 10 times, and it is the most memorable 15 hours of my life, for sure.
Does it mean something to you that you were the first for Canada?
Well, theoretically it does, but since it was the first for me, it was like if you ask a little infant, so, hey, those were the very first steps of your generation and your family, you know, for a little infant, that's their very first steps, and that's a big deal for them. I feel sort of like that little infant. Yeah, I recognize the significance of it, the fact that it opened doors for two other astronauts, Dave Williams and Steve McLean, to do spacewalks since then, but also it just gave us an increased capability as a country to do things for Canadians that follow in those particular ethereal footsteps.
You've definitely reinvigorated, I think, the country's interest in the space program and the space at large. And we're hearing a lot of discussions about, you know, like the Stop the Shuttle program, about what may happen with the future. Where do you think the CSA and NASA need to go from here?
Oh, I think despite a lot of transient negativity, I think both the Canadian Space Agency and NASA are doing a phenomenal job. We've been living off the planet for the last 13 years. We left Earth 13 years ago, and NASA is building follow-on vehicles. I mean, the shuttle was retired after a great period of 30 years of service. It was a natural thing to do, and they're building the next vehicle. The first test flight of that vehicle is later this year. It's called Orion. They're trying to privatize spaceflight as much as possible and have opened it to companies like SpaceX to build spaceships more autonomously. Within Canada, our new president of the Canadian Space Agency, Walt Mentenchuk, is doing a great job. Had a bunch of people go to the agency last week to help set the path. He's developed a really good relationship with the federal government. So and there's a lot of projects at work. You know, we have Canadian hardware on Mars. We use our satellites constantly to understand our weather and to communicate with each other and understand changes to the climate and to the atmosphere. I mean, we are learning about the rest of the universe. Canada is right in the thick of it all. So, I mean, we could use a bigger budget. Who couldn't? But with the money that we're given and trusted with, the Canadian Space Agency does a great job.
You know, we hear a lot of times about the benefits of the space programs being made in terms of, you know, scientific advances, going to the moon, going to the Mars, you know, planets beyond. But what about the social and, you know, economic benefits for us whose relationship with the realm of space is a little more fleeting or remote? How can that be meaningfully articulated for us lay people?
I think you can articulate it mainly two different ways. One is the direct application. You know, it's like saying, hey, we got all these laboratories in Canada. We have hundreds of laboratories in Canada. How come? You know, are they making a profit? What are they doing for us? Why are we putting money into laboratories? And, you know, it's kind of a transient question. But if you're not involved with those laboratories, it seems like a pretty logical question. And I think it's a valid enough one. In space exploration, there are lots of direct examples to that. Probably the best known one is Canadian robotics. You know, we started with our very first primitive robot on our first satellite back in 1962, and that led to Canadarm, where we sold many of those to NASA for the shuttle big robot arm for profit for Canada. And then we built the Canadarm2, which is the huge set of arms that's on the International Space Station. That was our ticket on board. And then what's more directly applicable, though, is that brought people together, and the engineering and the invention that came from that has led to robots that are used in deep mines, in nuclear power plants, but also in hospitals. We have hospitals in Canada doing brain surgery using robotic surgical techniques, where a doctor sits in a separate room with hand controllers and a robot inside an MRI machine with the patient actually goes in and removes brain tumors so that the surgeon can see exactly what she's doing. And so that that combination of investing, challenging people, coming up with new ideas, and then seeing all of the commercial spin-offs like that one, they're just a natural part of it. But the other side, I think, Dan, is important, and that is just the inspiration side. The people that tend to invent it and drive a lot of the important parts of our economy, they are inspired by exploration and by what we do right at the edge of our capability. It's what inspires them as kids to choose a career in engineering or science or technology or math or computers. And during this last space flight, we worked really hard with the Canadian Space Agency and myself to engage young Canadians, to let them see this incredible opportunity that exists for Canada, the challenge of it, the necessity to get an advanced technical education, to challenge yourself, and to maybe make different choices with your life as a result. And I think it's really important not only to have the laboratory and the results, but also to provide that level of inspiration and challenge for our young people. And I don't think anybody does it better than the space business.
You know, on that note of inspiration, you talk a lot about, you know, especially in your book, about, you know, your dream and how you achieved your dream. And I know that you struggled a little bit for a while, you know, after you sort of first enrolled. But what would you say to the youth out there, the of low-income families, you know, either victims of abuse or crime, say ones that are living in East Hastings or Jane Finch? All they know is sort of poverty and that sort of worldview. What would you say to them to inspire them?
Well, I think you're probably doing those young people a tremendous disservice by saying all they know is poverty. I think to a large degree, what they've had to deal with is poverty. What they've faced is poverty. What they've been dealt in life is largely driven by poverty. But that's not all they know, and that's not all they want. And what really matters is that we in this country can give everybody opportunity. And of course, you will never get it universal. It's a big, complex, structural society, and things go wrong, and it's never going to be perfect. It cannot be. And you need to spend a tremendous amount of your equity, of your gross national product or whatever, on taking care of your people. And Canada does a disproportionate, extremely large amount on health and welfare and education and opportunity for our young people, and trying to take care of people who have been through circumstantially disadvantaged. We do a lot. But at the same time, you have to give people things that are right on the edge of possible, things that inspire them, things that rise above the regular confusions and hassles and realities of day-to-day. That's not all there is to life. Otherwise, all they will know is poverty. You have to drive the economic engine of the country itself, and that comes from creativity and invention and marketing and inventing things that the rest of the world wants and wants to understand. And so I think we need all of that. We need the health and welfare that we focus on better in Canada than almost any nation on earth, but we also need the complex challenges that come with pushing the very edge of the things that we understand. So I think it's a big matrix, and you need to focus on all of those in proportion.
You talked about when you were growing up how you had to learn how to learn, and there's been a lot of talk, you know, in the last 5-10 years from a science perspective anyway, about the education system and whether it's functioning as it should. Do you think that it's getting in the way of kids' dreams? Is it acting as an inhibitor, or do you think it's doing what it should be doing?
Our education system is not perfect, and it's one of the best in the world. And of course, you can measure quality lots of different ways, and there's various people who make up some sort of standard, and then they can confidently say that our education system is the ninth best in the world. I don't know how you can guess to say, you know, with all of the variety and variables and interprovincial differences and things, but you need some sort of measure, and that's fair enough. We are one of the best in the world. You should not lose sight of that. We can definitely be better, and probably the way to be better is at a local, individual way. What are you doing? I mean, I ask you, Dan, what are you doing to make education
right?
What you can work with your own family or with your neighbors, or you could go volunteer at a school, or you could write a book, or you could donate money, or you could whatever, or you could decide to get involved in politics and try and have politics improve the education system. But I don't think, I mean, to say, is it getting in the way? It's an incredible enabler. And we have access to education in Canada that we take for granted that almost everyone else in the world just dreams of. We have a really impressive way of teaching our children, and of an expectation of stability and an expectation of access that applies to most people in Canada. And that, you know, it's by no means perfect. I've worked my whole life. I work with the Pan-Canadian Teaching Protocol. I've spoken in thousands of schools. On our last flight with the Canadian Space Agency, we built all sorts of educational products beyond some of the traditional ones to try and help people learn more. And I think it's really important. And I think if it's something that bothers you, that you think it's an inhibitor or something, then change it. Get it. And if you make no small change for the better, and good on you. And you've helped educate our young people better. And I think the responsibility lies with each of us.
The future of space travel, do you think that humans will go to Mars in the near future?
Well, why would we go to Mars in the near future? Why would you put a timeline on it? That's sort of the core question. What is the driving purpose? If it were free to go to Mars, then of course we'd go right away. If it were impossible to go to Mars, then we wouldn't. It's somewhere in between, and like most things. And Mars is going to teach us a lot. It is teaching us a lot about how planets form, about what's normal for planets, trying to understand what is the natural evolution and health of planets. Of course, it's really important to us is for sustainability of human life. What has happened to our Earth in the past and what's going to happen in the future that will limit human life or even largely eradicate human life? And there's lots of examples over the last billion years of things that have happened that would kill almost everybody on Earth. You know, asteroid impacts and huge sustained volcanic explosions and electromagnetic pulses from the universe and such. And they all apply to us. And some of that stuff we can learn from the history on Mars. Some we can learn from the history on the moon. Some from the history of the Earth itself. And the real question is, how much does it cost and how soon do we need the answer to give a sense of urgency? And the Earth, I mean, we're doing damage to the Earth, but the Earth does damage to itself. And it's still sustaining more people now than it ever has. And, you know, we need to be good stewards of it. We need to take care of the planet. And we're doing that. But in amongst that, our natural human history has been one of expansion around the surface. It took about 70,000 years on foot. And in the last 100 years, we've even not only just started to explore Antarctica, but now people live at the South Pole. And we're learning a tremendous amount about the planet by viewing it and understanding it from the South Pole, from the weather and the history. And that natural expansion is continuing vertically. And we've been living on the space station for the last 13 years. We've sent probes around the universe, or around at least the solar system. And as we expand vertically, I think we will go from the space station to the moon to Mars. But it's not a race. There is no great urgency. It's a natural extension of what we've been doing as a species since prehistoric times. And we'll take the best of our technology and go. And that's why we're on space station. That will take us to the moon. And I think between maybe a generation on the space station and then a generation on or two on the moon, then we will learn enough and have invented enough things that we can more cheaply and safely go to Mars. And eventually we will, but there's no big hurry.
I know that music has always been a big part of your life, and I'm curious where the original idea for you recording Space Oddity came from.
Oh, it came from everybody. I was amazed. My brother and I wrote a Christmas carol called Jewel in the Night, which I recorded on the space station and sent down, and my son Evan released onto SoundCloud. And many tens of thousands of people listened to that, and when they heard that there was a musician on the space station, they started clamoring via social media to have me record my version or a version of Space Oddity, which seems strange to me because you know, I'm a songwriter. Right? I wrote and recorded a whole sea of original music on station. It just seemed weird to do a cover of a song. But I did it sort of at the behest of many, thousands of people who were requesting it across the world, but then at the insistence of my son, Evan, who said, hey, you know, you really should. It's going to be really great. It's going to be a good platform, and you should give it a try. And so it was a father-son project, really. We just worked on it for a few months together and sort of came up with a better version than we thought we would, and enlisted the help of M. Greiner, who's a terrific Canadian musician. And she and I and Joe Corcoran put together that version, and then David Bowie gave us blessing to make a video. And so it was just kind of built on itself. It was really the driving insistence of my son, Evan, the help of M. Greiner and other musicians to put in the instrumentals, and then the request of thousands of people. And it's amazing, the result. It brought the reality of humanity off the planet. It's not just science and technology and robots on the space station. It's people. Yeah. It gives us a different perspective on ourselves. It's art and culture. as well as science. And there have been hundreds of millions of people who've seen that video. It's one of the, you know, top viral videos of all time, and it's changed people's perspectives, I think, on our own planet and exploration. So, an amazing thing for a father-son project, but very much a response to a widespread perspective and demand.
And finally, quickly, I know you mentioned M. Briner, but who would you say are some of your other favorite musicians or music that you're listening to right now?
You know, mostly I write and play my own music. I played in the Lou Reed tribute on Saturday night, and that was a lot of new Lou Reed music that I hadn't heard before. Some beautiful stuff, some very raw stuff, but an incredible talent. And being asked to sing one song as part of a big, long evening Lou Reed tribute, I learned a lot about Lou Reed, and it made me want to follow up more into his music. I like Brandi Carlile, actually. I really enjoy some of the stuff she's done. I think she's got a wonderful, distinctive voice and interpretation of music. But I'm actually getting ready to play a gig tonight. So I spend a lot of my time learning song, playing with Danny Michel and various Canadian musicians. It's just, there's so much great music out there, and the internet gives us access to so many different songs. Our band is playing a gig down in Houston on Thursday night, so I'm getting ready for that. So there's lots of music around. Most of it, though, is music that I'm learning and playing, and that's how I always love music the most, is to be involved in its creation.
Well, on that note, I will let you get ready for your shows. Commander Chris Hadfield, it's been a real treat talking with you today. Thanks so much.
Nice talking to you as well, man.
All right, cheers.
Bye-bye.
And that was Canadian astronaut and retired commander Chris Hadfield, and I spoke to him last week. All right, we're going to have another song from Spring off their album Celebrations. This is Pax Calx. Thank you. And that was Pax Calx by Spring off their album Celebrations. And this past week, I had a chance to speak with three members of Spring about their new project and album.
I'm here with Spring. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello. Hi.
Hello.
So, you recently underwent a rebranding. You used to be SSRI. How did Spring come out of that? And what was the impetus for sort of rebranding yourselves?
I think the SSRIs had some lineup changes. People came and went, at a certain point, it kind of became clear that we were all interested in doing different music than we have been doing with SSRIs, and the idea of having kind of a fresh start and launching a new project was really exciting to all of us. And Elliot and Joe had been doing SSRIs for 6 years or more, so it kind of seemed like if we were going to change the sound of it and start writing different things, that it would make sense to have a new name.
Is it an evolution or is it a do-over?
I'd say it's an evolution. It's just or an evolution or a continuation is how I put it. Like, half of the band's different, but on the other hand, a big part of the band is me and Joe working together, which we've been doing for quite a while now. So, yeah, it's an evolution. It morphed.
You mentioned sort of the different style of music from SSRI. How would you describe the differences?
SSRI is more like post-hardcore influence. More of like kind of weird post-hardcore. Spring is definitely more. I think they were more songwriting focused and more of a new psychedelic influence, less of the punk and hardcore thing, but I still think there is a bit of that in what we're doing. Not necessarily anything like the vocals, but definitely within just kind of maybe more the intensity in which we are playing the music live. So, and there's also, it's like there's also things that are not really designed or inadvertent in there, right? Like, it's like there's certain things I can't help but do as a musician that are definitely carrying over for both those bands.
Yeah, we all, I think we're, in our youth, we're heavily influenced and spent a lot of time playing punk and hardcore and listening to a lot of Fugazi and straight ahead hardcore and stuff. So I think that aesthetic or the, at least politically, a lot of that stuff carries over. Even though the music is somewhat removed from that, I think.
How would you describe the writing process? Do you write as a collective, as a group? Do you sort of each write on your own and then bring all your ideas together?
For this album, a lot of the parts, a lot of this, like the main structures, whatever, and like my part, I would write and then bring in, and then everyone would write their own parts, and we'd arrange kind of in a studio scenario as a band, both playing the song live, but also being like, oh, here's how we'll play it live when we're tracking it, and then this is what we'll eventually, like, when we have space here, or have this part here, so we'll eventually do this in the recording. There's like a few songs where I actually wrote all the parts or anything like that. A lot of it is, it's kind of a mix of the jam and also the jamming thing, and then also the total composer chart thing, which I thought, works pretty well.
Would you say when you're writing or you set out to write a song that you find a melody or rhythm first and then add lyrics over that, or do you come up with the lyrics and then try to write a tune that fits those lyrics?
Man, I've been looking into this a lot, because this is like a thing I've been looking at. For this record, I've done both in the past, but for this record, it was mainly, like, there were many drafts of lyrics for some of these song. So it was definitely a case of lyrics came after. But I definitely have written lyrics before, and it's really interesting. I've looked out on songwriting forum and also read about using the songwriters and their approach. It definitely does go both ways. It's amazing. It's surprising me how often it is lyrics afterwards for most songwriters. But what we are doing here, because we are kind of, there is like a compositional, music compositional focus too. I don't know, I like to think that they kind of happen at the same time in a funny way.
Do you find that the song has a different feel to it depending on whether lyrics or the music gets written first?
This is super ghetto. You just watched it.
It depends. There's a few different approaches. I know, like, you know. Yeah, I know. I think it could have a different feel.
I think one thing with this.
No, actually, I'm going to say no.
I think one thing with this band, as opposed to Astral Thrive, we knew that we wanted to have strong vocals on all the tracks, and I think we made an effort when, even if we did start writing music first, we made an effort to leave space for melody and for lyrics, because that's definitely a mistake I think we made in the past, was you write all this crazy music, and then you're like, oh shit, I have to sing something on this somehow. So I think even if the words didn't come, I think the melody was always going to be like a factor.
Sometimes also, I think when you're writing a song, this is often the experience with me, is that I'll know what I want the lyrics to be about as I'm writing the music, but I won't have written specific lyrics. And then I'll try and write lyrics based on it, and it'll take a very long time for it to just really, really work with everything. I think that was the case with the Secrets on the album. There's like a few drafts of lyrics, and I thought that was. Sometimes there'll be a chorus too that kind of came with the chords, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, this makes sense, the singer's part. I don't know. It's an interesting topic.
Kevin, you had mentioned earlier that, you know, between SSR and Spring, that a lot of the politics in many ways are still, or the ideas, the political ideas are similar. Is that something that you would say consciously try to write about or infuse in the music, the your political beliefs or ideologies?
Yes, the lyrics are not political, I don't think, in any way. The aesthetic of this band is not, I wouldn't say that we're a political band, but we are very political people, and so I think mostly just in ways in which you can manifest, like, having, like, a background with DIY certain kind of ethical things and the ways you conduct yourself. I think too, there's a certain energy that comes from people who are just engaged a little more in their daily world politically. If you think about, you know, the difference between like Minor Threat and then just a punk band that sings about, you know, getting drunk in a parking lot and that's it. There's a different visceral quality to it, even though the sound can be quite the same. Same goes for just, I think, having a little bit of, for me, on the drums, I always feel like no matter what you're playing, whether it's background jazz or a pop track or, you know, metal, whatever it is, it's nice when if things sound a little bit pissed, have a little bit of a fire inside whatever you're playing. So I think we, even though many of much of the material in this is very relaxed and very pretty slow and spacey, I think we all still have a lot of that background in our playing.
Yeah, there was a period when I was younger where I almost felt like it was a moral thing, like all bands ought to sing about was like political issues, and I like a lot of bands that sing about those things, but I'm also now open to bands singing about, you know, love songs or about their dreams or about, you know,
yeah.
whatever, or stories. So, you know, it's a broad spectrum of music, and I think being overtly political is one thing it can do, but it also doesn't have to. But it is also, you know, you know, how what a band does and just how who they are as people and their sort of ethics can, you know, doesn't have to necessarily be in the lyrics.
All right, Cliffy, favorite song of your album?
I really like Follow.
I like Axels these days. I go in phases, though. I've heard all the songs a million thousand times. It's really hard to decide if I even like them sometimes.
I like Pastel because it's still, like, just, well, I mean, it's really fun to play in, and it's trippy to listen to.
I think it's nice with this band, all the material. There's stuff that's quite challenging to play and stuff that's not necessarily challenging technically to play, but it's all really fun music to play, at least for me on the drums.
Yeah,
I wrote drum parts that are really fun to play over and over again, so I think that's we tried with writing the music to let everybody's the things that they really love to do with their instrument be present to some extent.
Well, Spring, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yeah,
cheers.
Yeah. And that was the band Spring, and I spoke to them last week in Vancouver. My next guest is a longtime member of the legendary avant-garde performance troupe Blue Man Group. In addition, he's also performed opera, Shakespeare, and appeared on TV in The Tonight Show and Arrested Development. He also describes himself as a lumberjack and ice cream aficionado. I'll have to ask him about that. He is Russell Rinker, and I spoke to him last week. I am joined on the phone by a blue man himself, Russell Rinker. Hello, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me.
So, you are part of the famed Blue Man Group troupe. I'm curious as to how you first got your start being blue.
Being blue, yes. Well, that is an interesting journey. I went to school for theater and have done music and theater pretty much all my life, and was doing a lot of classical theater, musical theater, and Shakespeare and stuff like that. And I did have a drumming background, but you know, I went to an audition and I had seen the Blue Man Group and just thought it was really unique and super interesting and weird and fun and crazy and pretty much, you know, just the kind of thing you want to be a part of. And just auditioned from there. And the company is great. You know, we have all types. Musicians, actors, dancers, clowns, you know, it's such a weird skill set to become blue, as you say, so it's great to have such a variety of performers, backgrounds.
You've, you know, you mentioned that you were, you know, you trained in Shakespeare at the Chicago Shakespeare Theater, and I know you've done opera and stuff like Shake It Up and Arrested Development. How different is something like Blue Man Group from sort of your more traditional acting, if you will?
Yeah, that's great question, actually. And it's, you know, obviously we don't talk, so that's going to be the first thing when you train. As an actor, you're very much, you know, about the words and the script and your voice. I mean, especially when you're doing musical theater and Shakespeare and whatnot, everything is all about the text, and that completely changes, you know, when you don't have any words. And I mean, obviously, we do. There is a story. There is a linear story that's progressing through the show, but we just don't say anything. But there is kind of a script, and there are three different Blue Man characters and personalities. So it's just. We're just using other tools to tell the story.
Given that you don't speak, what would you say some of your other senses and actions, you know, sight, sound, are that much more heightened?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great perception. I feel like, you know, the Blue Man is very, very primal, very innocent, has no ego. He's almost like a dog. And actually part of the training is to take the Blue Man trainees to the dog park and watch dogs interact with each other, because they're not judging. They're just kind of looking for the next thing and, you know, wanting to play and wanting to have fun. And the dog kind of is always following his nose, you know, just kind of reaching out with his nose and you know, looking for things in that way. And I feel like when I do the Blue Man show, my sense of smell is definitely heightened. And like I'm just following my nose like a dog. I don't know, maybe that's a mental thing, but I feel like I'm very aware of smells. And when you're not talking, you know, we're so busy just in our society, just, you know, waiting for your turn to talk. But when you're not going to get that turn for a couple hours and you think, okay, I'm just going to be here and observe, it really does make you more open and aware to the world, especially, you know, when you're playing this character that's just trying to take everything in and process it. So, yeah, I think it really does have an effect.
Given that you don't speak, I'm curious, did you have to do any mime work as part of your training?
Yeah, you know, that kind of comes up a lot when we talk about the show. The difference is, a mime is trying to give the illusion of something that is not there, you know, like a box or a rope or, you know, a breeze or something like that. But the Blue Man is very much just about what is in front of him and what is this thing, and we're all here looking at it. He's very much just in the moment, not trying to put on anything like that. So, I mean, we do, you know, obviously a lot of improv and physical acting training, similar, you know, to the way I guess a mime would train. We just don't kind of take it in that direction once you are developing those skills.
I know you said you had a little bit of a background in drumming. How would you sort of relate banging on PVC pipes and other sort of non-instruments to your more acoustic drum set?
Yeah, it's very similar. I mean, the main difference is that the Blue Man uses percussion communicatively. You know, we're trying to, it's very primal, trying to make a statement, trying to express himself, or basically this kind of primal urge that we're trying to awaken in the audience. As far as technique, you know, it's very tribal and very free. And yeah, the guys that we have drumming for the show, I mean, their drum set skills are just incredible. And we have a lot of different kind of drummers from the show. I had done like drumline and marching band and jazz band and stuff like that, but then we have rock drummers and hand drummers and guys that have, you know, studied it, every facet of percussion out there, and that's really, you know, their foundation too. So it's great to kind of be immersed in that musical world where everyone does kind of have different backgrounds, but it's all coming together for, you know, to kind of make that big tribal kind of statement, I guess, tribal statement.
How long would you say it takes you to get ready before a show and, you know, in full makeup and sort of that mindset?
Yeah, that takes about an hour. I mean, we show up about an hour and a half before each show. We do a sound check and kind of come together as a group, not just the performers, but the crew and everyone that's there. Blue Man was started by three guys and their friends, and they wanted to maintain that sense of community. So we kind of come together and form this kind of cohesive bond there with everyone that's in the space. And then the makeup process takes about an hour, and people, you know, ask about when do you become the Blue Man, you know, because you're just backstage and you're in these weird costumes. And I don't know exactly. It's kind of, at this point, after doing it for so long, it just kind of, you know, happens. But, you know, somewhere from the backstage area to the on stage, when you're walking out there and, you know, kind of closing your mouth and opening your eyes and mind and listening to that audience, you know, I think that's where it happens. And it's not hard, you know, if you think about it. Here I am standing with two of my friends on this huge stage in front of 2,000 or 3,000 people, and it's, you know, it's actually, as far as character goes, you really just have to put yourself in that position of the Blue Man.
Yep.
Here I am with a couple people, and we don't know exactly what we're going to do, but, let's just trust each other and try to make something fun happen. So it's kind of a luxury to play a character like that, as opposed to, I don't have to get myself super worked up emotionally, angry or sad or anything like that before the show. I just kind of go out there and open myself up, see what happens.
What has made you stick with it for so long?
That is a good question. When I first started doing it, I was like, oh, I'll do this a year. This looks like fun. But I think two things probably: the work and the quality of the people. The show itself, is not just the song and dance that's trying to get you to, forget about things and just have fun for a couple hours. I mean, we are striving for that, but there are deeper goals as far as the Blue Man, looking at people in our society and addressing these needs of the fact that we have fewer and fewer real experiences, and we're not connected to each other, and we don't look each other in the eye, and we don't play and imagine and create, and these things do happen, but not as much as they should. So it's kind of nice to be part of something that is trying to achieve these kind of higher goals. And when you see the show, you do get a sense of that. We want you to leave changed. To just have had an exuberant experience and have fun and so that's a very rewarding kind of thing to be a part of. And then likewise, the people involved, because you have people that are of that mindset, that they're really just great people. And like I said, the guys that built the show, started the show, just started it with their friends and like-minded individuals. And so people that are passionate about this, but also, just music and art, life in general, and it's really a great company to work for. So you kind of get into it and think, man, this is really a great thing to be a part of. I was only going to do it for a little while, but, it becomes harder and harder to leave.
Now, I've read this. Is this true that you're also an accomplished lumberjack?
Well, that is kind of true. That's a little something I've put in my bio. I think that's mainly for my parents, just to, rather than saying, hey, I love you, Mom and Dad, I kind of put that in there because I am from rural Virginia and we grew up, heating our house with a wood stove and fireplace. And so I have spent many a Saturday and Sunday afternoon out chopping wood. And I think about it in the show because we play this drum that is 6 feet in diameter, and we play it with this giant mallet that has a head on it like a basketball, and I just imagine that I'm chopping down a giant tree when I'm trying to summon the strength and energy to just keep wailing on that thing. So yes, I have never done that professionally, but definitely part of me.
Do you think that sort of the beating and the rhythm of the drum is similar to the motions of an axe?
What's that?
Like when you beat a really big or really loud drum, the rhythm of that is that similar to the motion of chopping with an axe?
Yeah, actually, especially at that moment, it is. It does kind of have that rhythmic feel. Also, like railroad workers, with the timing of the spikes and everything. I mean, there's certainly like percussive elements in that, yeah, it's kind of there. It's kind of, Blue Man is kind of tapping into that rhythm that is kind of running through your life that you aren't, aware of all the time, but seems vaguely familiar,
Yeah.
Hear it. Especially that part, the drum is kind of like a boom, boom, boom. And it's kind of meant also to simulate the heartbeat and then become the heartbeat of the rhythm of that part of the music in the show.
What did, growing up in a rural environment, what perspective would you say that gave you as an artist?
Wow, that's a great question. I did have several moments when I got to Las Vegas and was like, wow, how did a little country boy from Virginia end up performing in this weird show on the Las Vegas Strip? I think one thing, actually, when we were talking about just, you know, being open and not speaking, I think about that a lot because I grew up, you know, spending a lot of time in nature, you know, whatever, fishing, hunting, camping, hiking, stuff like that. And I think a huge part of that is just going out there and observing, you know, just taking in everything, and just kind of having that perspective of putting yourself out there and being aware that that is something that you need. That has never left me, and I think I kind of tap into that when I'm doing the show, because you're literally just putting yourself there and opening your eyes to the world and taking in little things, you know, appreciating things that you would normally take for granted. I mean, that's very much a huge part of the Blue Man character as well, just kind of noticing these little things and realizing there's something special about them.
And finally, I know it says that your true loves are ice cream and flea markets. So, what is your favorite ice cream?
Oh, wow, that is a good question. Have you ever heard of grape nut ice cream?
Grape nut?
Grape nut, yes, like the cereal. I think this is a regional thing that they just have in parts of the South and maybe throughout the Midwest. It's an ice cream that's made with grape nuts in it, and, you know, I know my grandma would always make sure that she went and bought some when I came home to visit, so, I mean, it's certainly the best, but also I have those kind of associations with it, so if you ever get the chance, definitely try it, grape nut ice cream.
Well, on that note, Russell Rinker, Blue Man Group, thanks so much for your time today.
Hey, thank you. You're welcome.
Alrighty, cheers. And that was Russell Rinker. I spoke to him last week. Well, that does it for CGSF on Endeavors at CGSF 90.1 FM. We're going to take you out with Pastel by Spring, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.